Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Patricia grows bored with her work on the Nez Perce Reservation. She prevents a woman's death after being called to a tribal member's house. The ambulance is here, Stan said, just about the time we lowered Peach into the hollow spot in the couch next to her corn husking and beadwork. I looked up from Peach's AccuChecks to see the same two EMTs who always responded to my calls. The dark-haired one they called Garcia, and the red one named Dale, who closely resembled youthful pictures of my daddy. Them. And me without oxygen or an IV going. The two hated my lackadaisical attitude, but I simply knew whether I was going to need a thing or not. In fact, in my 5 years on both the Nez Perce and Coeur d'Alene reservations, I never needed a thing on any home visit, emergency or no, I hadn't brought. You should have at least an IV going, Dale said. But her blood sugar's already over 60, I said, pissed as hell they were chastising me in front of my patients. You can't trust those things, Garcia said. She saved me, Peach said to Dale, who was tying the Penrose drain around her arm. Yes, she did, Stan said. You need an IV, the other one told Peach. I used the time to call Dr. Haskins, who, because of Peach's other risk factors, decided she should be evaluated at St. Joe's in Lewiston, gave word for the ambulance to transport. He would phone ahead, have Peach admitted. 4 days later, a Monday, I stopped early to check on Peach and Stan unannounced. They were out of bed but in their bedclothes, seated at the breakfast table. Stan with a grapefruit and an apple, Peach with slices of toast spread with peanut butter. Good enough. I gave my approval, told Stan to cook them each a boiled egg for later that morning. Come with me, Stan said. Peach wants to give you something. I followed him into a second bedroom full of stacks and boxes. The place smelled closed, busy with odors, mothballs, corrugated cardboard, old paper, furniture polish, plain cedar. To my right, another made-up metal bed. To my left, a dresser topped with pharmacy bottles and white IHS medicine sacks, a scene that set my fire alarms ringing. How many doctors were prescribing for these people? Where was all this medicine from? On the far wall of the bedroom, underneath the room's only window, facing south and the back of the property, was a beautiful cedar chest. Much like the blonde one that stored all my mother's favorite possessions, such as her fake mink coat, her high school yearbook, her just-in-case-I-have-to-go-to-the-hospital pajamas and robe, the rhinestone necklace that looked like an upside-down Manhattan skyscape, only this chest was taller, nearly waist-high. It was the source of the underlying cedar smell, strong as unbarked cedar fresh from the log, a cherished thing of my mother's mother, Grandma Kelty, who once had an ancient cedar tree cut to be made into a bedstead and chest. The craftsman got enough wood off the rest of the log to pay for falling the tree and making the furniture. Stan opened the lid, releasing the smell of naphthalene, of mothballs, and when I saw what was inside, saw what was about to happen, I was stunned, thrust into another suspended moment, this time life rolling quickly through my head, cartoonish as Saturday morning TV. I felt the glue that knows the order of things. I felt my mother and father being the ones to finally crawl out of 200 years of Kentucky hollers, so a grandchild of their mixed-blood parents could one day stand on an Indian reservation at the foothills of the Rocky Mountains in North Idaho, I felt my escape to the West turned into a 25-year journey that had done nothing but lead me to my beginnings. I felt how odd it was that the grandchild of these people happened to know to lay sugar paste under a dying woman's tongue. What Stan did was to bestow on me the honor of the Pendleton blanket. Made on the Umatilla Reservation near Pendleton, Oregon, blankets from that mill are treasured by Northwest tribes, decorated with various Indian motifs, typically patterns of Southwest design, and are presented at giveaways, weddings, as prizes at powwows, retirements, or when an employee leaves. Eventually, I would own three. One, woven with the figure of white buffalo calf woman I would purchase myself on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation, the one Stan was about to give me, and the one the Coeur d'Alenes gave me when I resigned my commission with the U.S. Public Health Service. The blanket was woven wool, gray bound with teal, a procession of matching teal, red, green, black, white, and navy blue triangles of varying sizes, creating a complicated quilt pattern, flocks of geese and Marion's Choice, alternate blocks of mosaic, strips of north wind across the ends. A royal blue tag printed with the Pendleton logo stitched to one corner which said, Beaver State, Regulation, U.S. Patent Office, Pendleton Woolen Mills, Pendleton, Oregon, Robes and Shawls. Stan handed me the thing still wrapped in plastic, fresh and folded, undisturbed as the day it came from the store. Inside, that new yard goods smell like clothes starch or sizing, but with something more. Sage, perhaps. The smell of blessing. My instinct was to hold it to my nose and inhale, imagining the comfort it would afford me on cold Idaho nights. I thought I should cry for this Indian man and woman, a physical way of proving my regard, but I remained straight-faced, fearful of appearing disrespectful. My heart felt without perimeter. Maybe they knew I was tired, that I wanted recognition but at the same time didn't, fearing people might expect me to replicate heroic acts. And then I remembered the terrorism of U.S. soldiers donating hospital blankets infested with smallpox. Who could argue this Indian habit turned genocide into generosity, rendered blanket giving a blessing? A thing meant to warm and comfort, protect against the ills of living and darkness, shelter from the seasons. An icon once woven with deception, now the currency of peacemaking, of tradition and commonality, of recovered nobility and love. May 23rd, 2001, Eagle Capped Wilderness, Oregon. The evening moves in. The losting grows louder the darker it gets. I listen for twigs snapping or rustling in the leaf sprouts of viney maple, bearberry, huckleberry, but it is pointless. One of these mountains could erupt and the sound would be lost. The smell of dusk is placental, mother's milk. On the other side of the river, boulders become imaginary bears. I'm sure when I avert my eyes, they have moved. I sit down in my beach chair to watch, clutch a stack of old journals, hoping deer or elk will step into the open and lean to the water to sip, maybe even bighorn sheep, all of which Mark and Brett and Zach and I have witnessed here. No vehicles have passed, no other campers. The afternoon has been dusty and alive with insects when there should be snow. At one point, a dozen or so monarch butterflies wisped and lit on my arms and legs. They inspired me. Afterwards, I spent the priceless hours writing this inventory, trying to paint a picture of what brought me here. You are the daughter of Kentucky Hill people. You immigrated west in the 1970s just before Saturday Night Fever ended your romance with the hippie era. It is 23 years later. Something is ending. Your life, the one you ran to when you were running from the Appalachian parentage. You rent movies with names like Silent Tongue, where an Indian woman haunts her white husband. For weeks he sits guard over her decaying body. He thinks her death is his fault. He was gone from camp and a group of anti-white zealots killed her for marrying a white. He imagines he has the power to bring her back. "Let me die," she begs. "Burn my body so I can begin my new existence." You sit guard over your mistakes. For example, you once followed an Indian Health Service locum tenens whom you barely knew to southwestern Colorado just to prove you were smart enough to figure how to make a complicated string of travel arrangements. You thought you'd found a mystical teacher, someone who knew. He was scary-looking, friend said, with a beak nose, gray Hasidic beard, hippie-length sputter of aging hair, emphysematous chest, and the whisk legs of a distance runner. He told you he'd survived cancer after receiving treatments in Mexico and traveled from IHS clinic to IHS clinic with his personal world organized into a collection of Rubbermaid bins. Whatever aura encircled him made you board a plane with a round-trip ticket but no dollars for meals, hotel, taxi, or souvenirs. You put yourself at his mercy. Why, you don't know, yet took pride in the fact that you survived his peculiarities, turning off of the ignition to coast down hills and save unauthorized miles in a federal vehicle sucking up Indian Health Service gasoline, the lectures that reduced you to tears in Telluride restaurants about the amount you eat, the ever-present briefcase and disappearances into bathrooms, followed by epileptic sneezing fits, the watch set to go off every 10 minutes, punishment because you failed to bring an alarm clock. He takes you to a town called Dove Creek, but won't take you to an ER when your period becomes hemorrhagic. 6 weeks later, you receive an envelope, return address the IHS imprint, and Toyoc Service Unit, Toyoc, Colorado. It holds a newspaper clipping titled, "Dove Creek Gets 911. But it doesn't end there. You return to Dove Creek again and again. You tell yourself if you ever own a piece of land, a place where you feel this at home, you will call it that. You will call it Dove Creek. Maybe it is the sound of the words that has you, yet the landscape staggers through you like a haunt. You feel commonality with the ghosts of lace pantaloon saloon girls who drop their opium vials between the wall boards. Perhaps it is the hopelessness of those women. The streets are dusty and abandoned, the store facades splintered and paintless, the windows old-fashioned bubble glass that shivers and wavers in the heat. Even 3 years later, in the spring of 95, you take your sons on a trip through the Southwest, stop in Dove Creek again, feel the same mystery clipped to your heart's red pumping. You wonder whether Dove Creek is a disease, a dark spot in the earth that cannot be defined in English, something your daddy didn't tell you or your mother. You know the worst of your family stories, the grandfather who went to prison for incest and the one who didn't, the uncle who murdered his wife, your father's murdered grandfather. But there's a blind tale still without narrative, and when you travel to Europe in 1995 and sit in a Dutch tavern staring at a row of black-haired, blue-eyed dolls lining a shelf along the back wall like a list of coffins, you burst into tears you can't explain, not even to the man sitting across the pine table from you, whom you count as your best friend because your commonality is another hill secret. It involves the grandfather who went to prison and your friend's grandmother, but neither of you can figure the details, since your grandfather lived in the pokes and hollers of South Central Kentucky, and the friend's grandmother in Virginia, and the two of you didn't meet until you were introduced by your lover, Vernon, in Seattle. The grandfather was dirt poor, and the grandmother the wealthy daughter of attorneys and judges, and what they shared, so far as you know, was nothing more than two small bottles, perhaps 2 ounces each, about the shape of a store-bought vanilla extract bottle and filled with tiny broken pieces of colored glass. The friend stashes his under his pillow at night, where previously it sat on his grandmother's kitchen drain board for the entire overlap of his and her lives, almost 35 years. You only remember the one that belonged to your grandfather. It sat in a shellacked wood cupboard he made by hand after his return from prison. The cupboard had rolled glass in the front doors and a block of wood spinning on a nail to keep them closed. Everything your grandparents owned was meager in this way. You come from the most feral white culture to have invaded this country and remain discordant with the civilized world. But that doesn't explain how something so exact and homemade could belong to two people whose lives were so disparate. And you even tried to convince yourself it was hallucination or insanity, except you remember how you used to beg your grandfather to open the cupboard and to let you touch the verboten in there, an empty tire patch can, a picture of your mulatto great-grandfather in his Spanish-American War uniform, whose tinged photo would survive nearly a century after his unsolved murder, a pickle jar of marbles, some big as and exciting as the earth, a flanged donkey that hopped when you squeezed the pink rubber bulb, a book about a dachshund you read 1,000 times, and one called The Pied Piper of Hamelin, the bottle crammed with both broken pieces of colored glass, your great-grandma's eyeglasses, a picture of your grandmother Hattie, the teacher, young and dark-skinned and lean from working the garden in the sun. And there is this. You have a son certain people insist you abandoned. You are enraged by this, but don't know how to abate their judgment. You believe in your deepest heart your actions saved him, but images haunt you. Images of being married to a man who demands you terminate a pregnancy or he will leave you with 2 children, penniless. You believe him. He shouts breath-hard lies and disgust, convinces you that you are inconsistent, deficient in moxie and mirth, traits he values but does not exhibit himself. The so-called abandonment of the son is therefore complicated. No one told you divorced women sometimes seek affirmation in the bodies of men. No one told you the notion of a blended family has not existed in your private cultural tree long enough to make the difficulties obsolete, that it is like trying to graft honeysuckle to a palm tree. No one told you that independent women are sometimes band-aids for men who at once yearn for and despise all that is feminine. No one told you such a man, when plugged into an existent household, becomes a third son, vying for dominance with the other two. No one has told you you might find yourself drinking to keep up with an alcoholic boyfriend so he won't leave, or that he might convince you to escort a son back to his father, a little shock therapy, as he calls it, claiming this action will debride wounds, foster more complete healing. No one told you the devil waits at any crossroads. Nor has anyone told you that Christmas Eve 1993, you will prepare a vegetarian lasagna from scratch, sauce simmered all day from Roma tomatoes, the skins of which you scalded and peeled yourself, that you will toast and grind spices from seed, dry from fresh leaf, noodles you would knead and press and carve, and that will you leave the masterpiece in a glass Pyrex dish, sitting on an electric stove burner turned to warm, and that you and the new man will leave your young sons alone while you dart about town delivering Christmas presents to people you barely know, stopping at a place called Tomfoolery, to share a holiday toast and a truth. Zach has to go, he says. I can't stand the anxiety in your household. No one has told you that you will return home to find Christmas dinner exploded, the walls and ceilings of your rented house covered in the blood of tomatoes, that you will blame the youngest son for having turned on the burner, for purposefully sabotaging the holiday, that he will scream, "You, Mom, I've had a hard life," and that you will slap him in the face.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer reading from her novel Dove Creek.
All the holly oxen free come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be.
Patricia is given a Pendleton blanket by Stan and Peach Franklin as she prepares to leave the Nez Perce Reservation. Back at the Lostine River, she writes a narrative inventory of her life. Finally, there is this. After you are transferred north to the Coeur d'Alene Reservation, you meet a clinical psychologist named Rhonda Denny. Rhonda is half Chippewa, although her parents raised her in white-bred urban San Diego and taught her to deny her Indianness. Rhonda arrives a few months after you do. You are each struggling with separate terrors. Your son's going to live with their father, a good friend's sudden horrible death in an auto accident, a breakup with the man who caused all the trouble with your sons, your mother's sudden onset, psychosis, and hospitalization. For Rhonda, moving to Idaho from San Diego signifies a break from family ties and a damaging relationship. She longs to find truth, hopes to familiarize herself with tribal customs, recover her native intelligence. She does this in part by studying the use of myth in therapy. She needs to practice on people. The technique requires you to draw, as she tells, a fable. So you sit at the old farm table in your kitchen in a caretaker's apartment on Liddy and Paul Yuknovich's horse ranch, where you are living after the departure of Vernon. It is the kind of table women in your line used to stand over pounding bread and biscuits. This one is missing flower bins and has been painted white, but you love its beat-up appearance and the way the old green milk paint shows through. You know you are unconsciously recreating your Kentucky heritage with the look, are surprised when it starts showing up in catalogs from a place called Pottery Barn. Rhonda sets you up with drawing paper and pens, and you begin. "Once there was a little girl," she says, "who lived in a very faraway land. The girl and her family were very poor, hard-working people, and everything they ate came from the land. They grew all their food with their own hands. The earth blessed them season after season, giving forth much food, so much that they had plenty to sell in town. They used the money to buy more seed and feed for their cows and horses and hens. The cows were generous, and every morning the girl's father filled bucket after bucket with warm, yellowy milk. The family had cream for their breakfast oats and butter for the bread made from wheat they had grown. And every day the hens brocked and brocked, laying egg after egg. It was the girl's chore to take the extra eggs to town. It has been said that if the hens were not so productive, perhaps the girl's fate would have been different. But the fact could not be changed that on her way to sell the family's eggs each morning, she was obliged to pass the leather craftsman's store. And every time she stopped to look in the window, every day staring at the same pair of perfectly sized bright red leather shoes, the girl wanted more than anything to dance. She had tried in her old farm boots, but her feet would not go where she wanted to put them. She was sure she could dance in those beautiful red shoes. If she only had the red shoes, she could dance better than anyone in town. She could dance across Europe. People would love her everywhere. People would throw coins at her. Handsome men would ask her to dance. Even though the girl's family received much bounty from the earth and the animals they loved and cared for, still the rent on the house and the land was expensive, as were the taxes. Each year the tax man came with a bucket the girl's father filled with coins they'd received from the people who bought their goods. So, despite their plenty, the family remained poor. This did not stop the girl from pining for the red shoes. It did not stop her from wanting to dance. She thought if she wanted them hard enough, they would somehow come to her on their own. Each morning, on her way from delivering the eggs to market, she stood at the leather craftsman window to stare and imagine herself dancing in those fine red shoes. Finally, one day, the leather craftsman invited her in to try on the shoes. They were a perfect fit. The leather craftsman felt bad for the girl and so went to her father and offered to trade the shoes for one of the cows. "But I need the cream and the butter from all my cows to sell at market," the father said. "Then trade one of the horses. the leather craftsman said. But I need my horses to pull my plow, the father said. The leather craftsman left sadly because he was fond of the girl. Still, he made little money himself and could not afford to give away such a fine example of his workmanship for free. The father had an idea, Rhonda continues. He and his wife, the girl's mother, set about making a pair of red slippers. They cut perfect shapes from old hat felt, sewed them, and dyed them with beets and currants. The shoes were beautiful. They looked exactly like the ones from the leather craftsman's store. The next morning, the mother and father woke the girl a bit early. The mother had prepared a special breakfast of sweet cakes with blueberries and maple syrup. The wheat for the cakes had been grown by their very hands, as well as the cane for the sugar. They'd picked the blueberries from their very own patch and caught the maple syrup from their own trees. It was a beautiful feast, and the father even used some of his coins to buy wrapping paper and a ribbon his daughter could later use to tie her hair. The mother helped the daughter dress in her best dress and tied a kerchief around the daughter's perfect eyes so that she mightn't see the surprise too soon. Then both mother and father led the daughter by the hand to the wooden table in their kitchen. "Surprise!" they both said, holding hands and laughing. The girl was excited, jerking the kerchief off her eyes. When she saw the package, she understood what her parents had done. They had bought her the leather craftsman's perfect red shoes. And so she tore away the beautiful colored paper. "Oh!" the little girl exclaimed. "These aren't the ones! How can I dance in these? I can't dance in these!" She looked at the handmade shoes and cried. The mother and father were very confused. They didn't understand the meaning of the word dance. They felt ashamed. The mother turned her back to the table, picked up the apron she'd taken off because this was such a special day, and walked away. The little girl ran from the house and wandered the woods crying as hard as she could. Her mother and father and the entire village hunted for her, calling and singing their mountain songs. The day grew soft and gray, and still they had not found her. The next morning, the leather craftsman saw that someone had thrown a rock through the window of his store, and the perfect red shoes were missing. Of course, he knew who had taken them, and so confronted the little girl's parents. "You must pay," he said to them. What could the little girl's father do? He went to the stone cellar and unburied his bucket of coins, counting the amount the leather craftsman called for. The girl's father was very sad. Meantime, the little girl danced her way over the mountain in her new red shoes. She danced and danced. She danced in the meadows, the forest, through the creeks. She danced past sheep and cows and tiny baby deer. She danced up the mountain and down the mountain. She danced through rivers and the last of the spring's remaining snowdrifts. She danced past barns and farms and bent over women and children working in the season's wheat. She danced through towns and orchards, past kings and pirates and beggars. She danced past schools and nurseries and cathedrals. She danced past oceans and deserts. She danced until the moon went down and the sun came up. She danced and danced for weeks. Finally, the girl was tired of dancing. She couldn't eat or drink water. She couldn't sleep or play with the baby deer. She couldn't sit to listen to mountain people singing. She couldn't swim or put on a new dress. Most of all, she didn't feel as happy as she had when she was working with her mother and father and the cows and horses and chickens and the land that gave them so much food. Even after dancing across all of Europe with many people throwing coins and handsome men holding her on marble piazzas into the night, what good were coins when dancing feet jostled them out of her pockets? What good were handsome men when she was only a girl? Finally, the little girl danced her way back home. Her mother and father and the leather craftsman and the townspeople were so happy to see her that they forgave her everything, even stealing the shoes, even the broken window. But try as they did, no one could remove the shoes from the girl's feet. They tried pulling them off with ropes and horses. They tried soaking them off by placing the little girl's feet in a bucket of grease. They tried cutting the stitches that held the leather together. They tried slicing the leather with the butcher's knife. The priest tried praying them off. Meanwhile, the little girl danced and danced all night and all day she danced. One morning the little girl made herself dance out the door of her parents' house. She danced all the way to the village and into the butcher's shop. "Cut off my feet," she said. "I want you to cut off my feet. I want to sleep. I want to eat. I want to deliver my eggs." The butcher was very sad, but had seen all the trouble the dancing shoes had made for the girl. He secretly loved the girl and wanted her to one day marry him. But he also wanted the little girl to have her wish. He wanted her to deliver her eggs and stop dancing. And so he did as she asked. He cut off her feet, which continued to dance in the beautiful red shoes, out the door, down the street, never to be seen again. In the picture you draw as Rhonda reads, your head is surrounded by a wreath of hearts, and at the bottom of the page, you have no feet. For the safety fair, our doctors ran tricycle races to promote bicycle safety. Leonard Wahobin demonstrated how to turn milk jugs into life preservers. Toby Perez explained fireworks safety. There was face painting and blood glucose screening. You could pitch softballs at a bullseye target to try and dunk the service unit director in the dunk tank. I ran the Wheel of Misfortune. The Wheel of Misfortune was not my invention. An AIDS educator named Manuel Garza, who once visited the health department in LeGrand, gave me the idea. He'd created the thing to provide engaging visual stimulus for migrant Mexican workers, who at the time had one of the fastest-growing HIV rates in the country. It was a simple contraption Moose built for the occasion, a wheel of wood mounted on a stand and divided into pie pieces, painted various acrylic colors, stop pins at the separations. People were required to spin to determine their fates. Pregnancy, herpes, syphilis, chlamydia, gonorrhea, HIV, genital warts, crabs, and the equal possibility that luck prevailed and no disease was transmitted. I chose one couple at a time to stand before the wheel and listen to a story. You're at Chief Joseph and his warriors' powwow, and you've just met the brother of last year's winner at the 21 and under. The two of you go to his truck to listen to his new Jim Boyd CD, smoke a joint, and drink a sip of Irwin Big Creek's melon wine the dancer stashed under his seat. One thing leads to another, and you end up having sex without a condom. Spin the wheel to determine your fate. Or, school let out for the summer. You've made plans with a group of girlfriends to meet some guys on the hill behind the clinic. You are worried because you're supposed to go straight home to cook for Tomek's, but you know they bought beer from one of the stock boys at Valley Foods. You go with them because it's your 16th birthday and you feel like it. Everybody drinks for a while, then breaks into couples. A guy from your algebra class rolls on top of you and won't let you up. You submit instead of fighting. Spin the wheel to determine your fate. Or, there's a woman from the Portland area office who just started auditing work at Fisheries. You can't stop looking at her legs. You ask her out, take her to Lewiston to Jonathan's for a fancy dinner, and she invites you to her hotel afterward. Spin the wheel to determine your fate. The couple then spins the wheel. The arrow clicks against the pegs, passing HIV, chlamydia, and lands on pregnancy or syphilis or gonorrhea. The couple is then obliged to wear a sign pinned to their shirt backs all day pronouncing the verdict. HIV has its skull and crossbones. Pregnancy is a computer printout of a fetus. Luck is a smiley face. Everyone laughs, claps, and the couple earns a midnight kiss, a condom and starlight mint wrapped in midnight blue cellophane, tied with a pink ribbon, and patient information brochures warning of the 9 consequences of unprotected sex. About this time, the Army Corps of Engineers drew down the water in the Snake River to try to save the salmon. A river drawdown manipulates water levels so salmon can survive the locks for the return upriver to spawn. The river became low, thick, and sludgy. Many things emerged from their previous places of quiet. Cars, musical instruments, enormous tree trunks. But most interesting were the pieces of a butchered Nez Perce man named Bear. He had been missing for years. Eddie Dakota was one of the criminal investigators on the case. No one really knows why Bear was murdered, except that he was in the wrong place at the right time. Which meant, of course, his right place was empty. My mother's eyes dancing. Heavens. May 23rd, 2001, Eagle Cap Wilderness, Oregon. I don't know why I grabbed these particular notebooks to bring with me, but I thought burning a few might afford me the right kind of purging. But I'm thinking what I crave is absolution. And absolution in religion and mythology always involves the two main things I have here with me in this place, water and fire. Obviously, from the journals, however, this trip to the Lost Dean is not my first attempt at trying to extract reason from pain and loneliness. 3:06 p.m. Pacific Time Zone, Whitebird, Idaho, December 23, 2000. From my earliest days, I recognized myself as a watcher. Maybe I did not know, but I saw, suspected. But when I told stories about what I saw and suspected, I was punished for lying. Lying was called telling stories, as in, "Aw, you're just telling stories," which was, of course, same as stealing in the eyes of God and His Son Jesus. When I came home from first grade and told my mother I had to copy an entire book by hand, I was beaten for telling a story. When my second grade class visited the Louisville airport and I came home talking about how we taxied the runway, which of course made my daddy call the teacher and the school's principal to complain, and which of course he was told we most certainly did not do any such thing, I was beaten with a redbud switch for telling a story. It was quick training. And I was a good student. I learned to save myself by keeping quiet. But by my late 30s, all those words sacked up like peanuts inside me were starting to make me sick. I was so full of things I hadn't said, I had no room for food. I got down to about 120, 30 pounds less than my Scottish Cherokee African bones required. Doctors could find no reason for my loss of appetite, and at first I was ecstatic. I'd been on a diet since I was 12, but I was trained as a nurse and smart enough to know not eating would soon kill me, and luckily listened to myself when I began to suspect the cause might be related to something Leonard Wohoban told me. He said, "If you've got something to say and you don't say it, it'll make you sick." I came up with what I thought was a bright solution. I decided to write it all down. Like a guinea worm or gonna worm or whatever they are called, I began to pull the threads of my life experiences out of my body, a pen and paper inch at a time. The best idea I could come up with to further help me along was to take a college class in mythology, which I thought of from my days in high school Latin classes as tale-telling at its purest. I called the local university and somehow or another ended up in a Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing, even though I had no clue what that was. I soon enough found out. It's a place where you go broke drinking beer at night and sit around during the day in what they call workshop while other people try to huff out your light. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer reading from her novel, Dove Creek. Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.